1.2 million Americans have now been canceled by their insurance companies.
Canceled your show.
And Futurama's been canceled.
Canceled.
Canceled too soon.
Is officially canceled.
Be canceled twice.
His launch pre-order bundle was canceled. Do we know it's a his?
Have been effectively canceled.
And abruptly canceled.
From Target is canceled.
Or unceremoniously canceled.
Plan was being canceled.
The cabal has been canceled.
Look at the role of the Rothschild family.
Money and power.
Monsanto and a few other chemical companies.
Culling the population through eugenics is their answer.
The World Bank, the International Monetary Fund, IMF, and the World Trade Organization.
These are the most disgusting people on the face of this earth.
Or they control the information.
The powerful few people who run this planet.
They're not as powerful as you think.
Good evening, ladies and gentlemen. Now brings you Cancel the Cabal with Stephen Roberts. Stephen Roberts. Stephen Roberts.
Red or blue?
Yes, good evening, good afternoon, or good morning. Whatever the case may be, whoever's listening, all over. I'm Stephen Roberts. This is Cancel the Cabal on Shake and Wake Radio and PSN Radio and SoFlo Radio, Southern Florida Radio. Find my readers here. I am going to continue reading on a real Anthony Fauci. Bill Gates, Big Pharma, and the global war on democracy and public health. I just thought of something. Last week I was at a doctor's appointment. My rheumatologist and a few days before that, took some blood for the doctors, the many doctors that want my blood for whatever they're tracking, and the phlebotomist. We got to talking about all this, and she said, "I'm sick of these masks and stuff." And I said, "Well, I told her, you know what? Everybody in this hospital that works here, you can get rid of that mask mandate in 2 days." And she said, "Yeah, I know. Everybody just walked out for 2 days. It'd be gone. All the hospitals. Every business all over the world, virtually. They walked off for 2 or 3 days. It'd all be gone. Mask mandates. The vaccination mandates, period. I'm betting. But the sheep are too afraid to do that. Too afraid to stand up to their masters. We're getting closer and closer and closer to the end of this book here. I don't know whether I'm going to read his ending thoughts or what. The afterword. Probably will. Maybe. Maybe not. I don't know. But there's a, let me see, I'm just trying to count here. It's got a snot load of citations, that's for sure. A lot of citations. A lot of other a lot of other people's works. I'm betting that he's citing. Well, we're on page 485 of 435. So it's going to be at least a couple more weeks, I'm betting. Yeah, well, I don't know if his citations are going to have snob words or not, but who knows? I guess we'll have to see, Mark. Ten months before the Al-Habris brought the plant, the FDA audit uncovered contamination problems, suspect record keeping, and assorted security breaches at their laboratory, as well as 9 million stored doses that were adulterated almost as soon as Bioport was formed. It began receiving large sums from the U.S. Army to rehabilitate the anthrax plant. But it was still unable to pass the FDA audit. In 1999, they bulldozed the factory and rebuilt it at taxpayer expense. The state of Michigan sweetened the deal, but the FDA would not give its stamp of approval to the new manufacturing plant, Bioport. With a hefty lobbying team and designer furniture in its executive offices kept crying poor and coming back to the U.S. government for additional handouts, before finally falling into a death spiral around the bankruptcy drain in mid-2001. The October 2001 anthrax incident proved that the Al-Habris salvation. The Pentagon leveraged these strange attacks, turning them into a long-awaited provocation, justifying the crusade to expand the battlefront in bioweapons research. In 1972, biological weapons convention meant neither the brass nor the spooks could legally research or produce bioweapons. But the convention left open the loopholes that signatories could develop dual-use vaccine and weapon technologies so as long as the projects had a defense rationale. After the anthrax attacks, vaccines suddenly became a euphemism for bioweapons and a ticket back to deep water for a breached bio-warfare industry. Military planners at the Pentagon, BARDA, and DARPA, and the CIA through USAID began pouring money into the gain-of-function experiments. Dual-use search was suddenly in vogue. Dark winter 2001. During June 22nd and 23rd 2001. Less than 3 months before the 9/11 attacks, the Pentagon launched a war game coded Operation Dark Winter at Andrews Air Force Base that emphasized the military's earnest commitment to bioweapon vaccines. Robert Cadillac, the lead organizer of this pandemic simulation, also coined its codename. The tabletop scenario simulated a smallpox attack on U.S. locations beginning in Oklahoma City, the site of real domestic terror attack in 1995. Yeah, that's when the FBI blew up their own building. Dark Winter participants explored certain strategies for imposing coercive quarantines, censorship, mandatory masking, lockdowns, and vaccination, and expanded police powers as the only rational responses to the pandemic. The failure in the Dark Winter case to quickly implement such countermeasures, allowing the galloping spread of the Pentagon's imaginary smallpox epidemic to overwhelm America's response capabilities, precipitating massive civilian casualties, widespread panic, societal breakdown, and mob violence. The Pentagon summary of this exercise concluded that scarcity of vaccines to curtail the contagion's spread proved the most severe limitation on the management options. The Dark Winter exercise eerily predicted many aspects of what would follow just months later with the anthrax letter attacks. Such uncanny miracles of foreshadowing became a recurring feature of each subsequent germ gain. Yeah, it's almost like they knew what was coming. It's uncanny. It's almost like they knew what was coming. The spooks and the simulations. By playing the role of U.S. President, the Senate Defense Committee's lifetime chairman, Senator Sam Nunn, a dyed-in-the-wool war hawk, brought prestige, urgency, and a militaristic gestalt. There's a snob word for you. G-E-S-T-A-L-T. Gestalt. To Cadillac's Dark Winter exercise. Most of the other key participants shared Cadillac's intelligence agency pedigrees. CIA involvement was a consistent feature of this and all the subsequent simulations. Other participants included Robert Cadillac's fellow intelligence officer and War College professor Colonel Randall Larson, U.S. Air Force. Another career bioweapons expert who helped choreograph the exercise appeared in its fictional scripted news clips. CIA's former director James Woolsey was a participant and organizer, as was the pharmaceutical industry lobbyist and biological weapons expert Tara O'Toole, a director of the CIA hedge fund NQTEL. The CIA's former deputy director for science and technology, Ruth David Hopkins, bioterrorism expert Tom Inglesby, and the New York Times journalist Judith Miller also participated. James Woolsey's presence and that of Colonel Larson, Ruth David, and Tara O'Toole signaled the intelligence community's ubiquitous but shadowy presence in biosecurity and all things vaccine. I sat on the board with Woolsey for several years, and I am familiar with his deep anxieties about germ warfare. Woolsey's germophobia rivals Cadillac's. Woolsey calls a biological weapons attack the single most dangerous threat to U.S. national security in the foreseeable future. O'Toole is a biodefense enthusiast, co-founder of the Johns Hopkins Center for Civilian Biodefense Studies, and executive vice president of the CIA's investment arm in QTEL. That shady firm is the vector by which U.S. intelligence services infiltrate startup firms on the cutting edge of technological innovation. O'Toole, like her longtime confederate Cadillac, juggles deep and disturbing relationships with the same retinue of... Another snob word coming. Rapacious pharmaceutical industry and military contractors like that Cadillac also cultivated. In 2009, when President Obama nominated O'Toole for Undersecretary for Science and Technology at the Defense at the Department of Homeland Security, Senator John McCain criticized her for concealing her role as her strategic director of the pharmaceutical industry lobbying outfit, Alliance Biosciences. Alliance is an unincorporated corporate front group created by Ibrahim El-Hibri and his partner, former Joint Chiefs Chair Admiral William Crow, and funded by other bioweapons firms. Alliance has no tax filings and operates out of a K Street influence shop. The congressional record shows that the Alliance is a so-called stealth lobbying firm that spends $500,000 over 2005 to 2009 pitching Congress and the Homeland Security Department for a greater biodefensive expenditures, and particularly for anthrax vaccines. Now the trick's going to be to turn a page without losing all the other pages. Getting down that far and they're quite stiff still. Alliance's other funders include Pfizer, the International Pharmaceutical Aerosol Consortium, and SIG Technologies, a biodefense military contractor. O'Toole's nomination to Undersecretary at the Department of Homeland Security also prompted objections from more mainstream bioweapons experts, including the preeminent Rutgers microbiologist Richard Ebright. She was the single most extreme person, either in or out of government, advocating for a massive biodefense expansion and relation and relaxation of provisions for safety and security. Ebright added, "She makes Dr. Strangelove look sane." O'Toole supported every flawed decision and counterproductive policy on biodefense, biosafety, and biosecurity during the Bush administration. O'Toole isn't out of reach with reality and paranoic. It would be hard to think of a person less well-suited for that position. During the same 2009 confirmation hearings, Democratic Senator Carl Levine of Michigan added to the voices of skepticism. Dr. O'Toole fell short of a strict adherence to scientific principles when she was the director of the Johns Hopkins Center for Civilian Biodefense Strategies, noting that Dr. O'Toole was one of the principal designers of the and authors of the 2001 Dark Winter exercise that simulated a covert attack on the United States by bioterrorism. Levine faulted O'Toole for using the exercise to promote her biosecurity agenda with hyperbolic pandemic fantasies. But many top scientists have said that the Dark Winter exercise was based on faulty and exaggerated assumptions about the transmission rate of smallpox. Dr. James Koopman of the Department of Epidemiology at the University of Michigan made the ungenerous assessment that O'Toole's enthusiasm for germ warfare had clouded her scientific judgment. Koopman, an expert on modeling the transmission rates of infectious diseases, who participated in a smallpox eradication program, complained that Dr. O'Toole had not sought balanced scientific input in her thinking, that she shows a lack of analytic orientation to scientific issues, and that she has generated hype about bioterrorism and she will feel obligated to defend rather than pursue a balanced approach. Dr. Michael Lane, a former director of the Centers of Disease Control Smallpox Eradication Program, likewise condemned O'Toole for peddling her assumptions about smallpox transmission rates in dark winter, which he characterized as improbable and even absurd. Ironically, even Dr. Fauci, who by then was already the king of embellishing and fabricating pandemics, voiced his disapproval for O'Toole and Cadillac's extreme dark winter exaggerations, which Dr. Fauci declared much, much worse than would have been the case in real life. The transmission of smallpox was not only the area where Dr. O'Toole and Cadillac ignored facts. On February 19, 2002, O'Toole wrote that many experts believe the smallpox virus is not confined to these two official repositories, one in the United States and one in Russia, and may be in possession of states or subnational groups pursuing active biological weapons programs. O'Toole cited a June 13, 1999 New York Times article as a source for her alarming assertion that subnational groups controlled smallpox stocks. But that article included no reference to any non-state groups, actors, possessing any biological weapons. Another key dark winter planner and participant was Ruth David, the former deputy director at the CIA. In 1998, David became president of ANSCR, a nonprofit corporation with deep ties to the CIA. ANSCR played a key role in pushing the government toward homeland security post 9/11 and became a primary promoter of biometric and facial recognition software for the U.S. law enforcement agencies. Among other functions, ANSCR funds a mysterious defense contractor from South Carolina called Advanced Technology International, ATI. ATI somehow became the vector through which the government arranged at least $6 billion of secretive Operation Warp Speed vaccine contracts with Pfizer. Bill Gates' Novavax vaccine, Johnson & Johnson, and Sanofi. These contracts compromising the majority of Operation Warp Speed $10 billion budget. Operation Warp Speed's $10 billion budget. Suggest a deep CIA involvement with COVID-19 vaccine enterprises, cozy deals with Big Pharma. Really? They're all connected. As Assistant Secretary of Preparedness and Response with HHS, Robert Cadillac personally signed off on those sweetheart deals. The terms allow Operation Warp Speed to completely bypass the regulatory oversight and transparency of the traditional federal contracting mechanisms, as NPR put it. In the January 21 expose, the New York Times dug into Cadillac's secretive vaccine contracts, observing this available documents suggests that drug companies demanded and received flexible delivery schedules, as well as patent protection and immunity from liability if anything goes wrong. In some instances, countries are prohibited from donating or reselling doses, a ban that could hamper efforts to get vaccines to poor countries. Dark winter aftermath. Despite all its hiccups, dark winter was an extraordinary success. It foreshadowed the real bioweapons incidents occurring less than 3 months later. Yeah, it's almost like they knew something was coming. Again. It foreshadowed the real bioweapons incidents occurring less than 3 months later. Inflamed public germophobia and fortified the official narrative from the first September 18th anthrax attack letters, which pointed fingers at Saddam Hussein and or Al-Qaeda as the probable culprits. Several Dark Winter participants displayed extraordinary prescience in the weeks leading up to the anthrax attacks, along with a relentless determination to pin the caper on Saddam. The anthrax attacks' first casualty, Robert Stevens, was hospitalized and diagnosed with anthrax on October 2nd. Highly publicized and laudatory Senate hearings on the Dark Winter simulations that began on October 1, 2001, 3 days before the anthrax attacks became public knowledge, functioned to imbue, sounds like another snob word, U.S. government officials, the national press, and the public with Dark Winter's paranoid assumptions, and to assess the blame to Saddam. Another Dark Winter planner, Jerome Hauer, along with the spy master Jane Woolsey and the New York Times reporter Judith Miller, spent the 3 weeks between 9/11 and 10/4 banging the gong about imminent anthrax attacks, carpet bombing the television talk shows, kibitzing. That's a Yiddish word, I think. Kibitzing. K-I-B-I-T-Z-I-N-G. On the nightly news. Well, it's probably a Yiddish snob word. Kibitzing on the nightly news and gabbing up the Sunday morning TV gas bags. Judith Miller received special assistance in this task from her employer, the New York Times, which published her numerous alarmist reports and warnings about coming biological attacks on American soil. Incredibly, the attack arrived exactly as Miller, Hauer, and Woolsey predicted, huh? And was exquisitely timing smack in the middle of the U.S. Senate hearings over America's vulnerability to an anthrax attack. Hauer, a bioterrorism expert and pharmaceutical industry operative, is currently an executive with Tenio, a consulting firm that counsels corporations on security matters, and is one of the leading advocates of mandatory vaccines for employees as a condition for employment. Alrighty, take the first break right here, everyone. It's gone by pretty quick here. So mark my spot. And let me see here. I think I need something also to go in between my readers and something that's a little bit mid-range as far as seeing. Some other things are a little bit difficult to see. I got, what says, track number 2 here for the break song. Be back in 5 minutes and 49 seconds, everyone. Okay, welcome back, everyone. As I did, like I do sometimes, I forgot to mention in the first segment to support all the stations, Shake and Wake, SoFlo Radio, and PSN Radio. Support them with a donation, please. Members of the think tank, the Project for the New American Century, PNAC, also played a key role in the sounding the alarm of a biological weapons attack was certain to follow on the heels of 9/11, and then simultaneously amplified the panic and blame Iraq following the anthrax letter attacks. PNAC's core doctrine was that as the Cold War vector America and the U.S.-based multinationals, particularly petroleum and pharmaceutical companies, had earned the right to rule the world for a century or so, PNAC members populated virtually all the key foreign policy posts in the Bush White House. The warmongering cabal called themselves the Vulcans, in honor of their belligerent brand of U.S. imperialism. Their members included Dick Cheney, Scooter Libby, Donald Rumsfeld, Douglas Feith, Elliot Abrams, John Bolton, and Rumsfeld advisors Richard Perle and Paul Wolfowitz. Critics called them the Chicken Hawks because, ironically, each one of them had draft dodge the Vietnam War. Osama bin Laden, the author of the World Trade Center attacks, supposedly directed that operation from an Afghan cave with a laptop. He didn't put that. I did. Donald Rumsfeld complained, "There aren't any good targets in Afghanistan. Yeah, nothing but desert and caves that you can't see in." The PNAC Chicken Hawks were determined to use 9/11 as a pretext for war against Iraq, beneath which God had mischievously stockpiled so much of America's oil. Anthrax provided that precaution. Control of global oil resources was, for PNAC, the key stepping stone for the coming century of American imperialism. The bioweapon attack against America became the identical provocation for preemptive invasion. It's noteworthy that Judith Miller not only covered the Dark Winter exercise for the New York Times, she was also an active planner and participant in the simulation, playing the part of a reporter. Yeah, she's always played a part of a reporter. Miller was an OG germaphobe and veteran biosecurity booster. On September 4th, 2001, exactly 1 week before the 9/11 attacks, Miller, exerting from a paranoid book, Germs, she had written with Times reporter William Broad and Steve Engelberg, reportedly approvingly in the New York Times that the Pentagon had greenlighted a project to make a potentially more potent form of anthrax bacteria. Miller did not explain why this response seemed rational or even sane. Miller's articles repeating Pentagon and CIA claims that Saddam's bioweapons cache and his probable involvement with the anthrax attacks helped fuel the U.S. invasion of Iraq, according to the New York Magazine. During the winter of 2001 and throughout 2002, Miller produced a series of stunning stories about Saddam Hussein's ambition and capability to produce weapons of mass destruction. almost all of which have turned out to be stunningly inaccurate. Miller's jingoistic reporting, another snob alert word, New York Magazine dubbed her Chicken Little, played such a decisive role in validating the White House warmongers' Iraqi invasion agenda that the New York Times afterward made an unprecedented apology for its role in what then was arguably the worst foreign policy decision in New York history. Miller was also keen to facilitate an Iraq invasion, and she illegally leaked the identity of the CIA agent, Valerie Plame, to punish Plame's husband, State Department diplomat Joseph Wilson, who had publicly challenged the White House and CIA narratives about Iraq obtaining yellow cake uranium from Niger. The CIA at the time was aggressively pushing for war. George W. Bush later said that his worst mistake during his White House years was swallowing the CIA's guarantees. The biggest regret of all the presidency has to be given the intelligence failure in Iraq. Was it no failure? It was all scripted. A lot of people put their reputations on the line and said the weapons of mass destruction is a reason to remove Saddam Hussein. In 2003, during the run-up to the war, CIA Director George Tenet assured President Bush that Saddam had a secret arsenal of weapons of mass destruction, WMDs. Don't worry, it's a slam dunk. Miller served 3 months in jail for contempt before she agreed to disclose the identity of her confederate, Lewis Scooter Libby, Vice President Cheney's chief of staff. Libby, who told Miller that Plame was a clandestine CIA agent, and directed her to publish the revelation, subsequently went to prison for the crime. It will be many years before CIA releases documents explaining the agency's true relationships, if any, with Miller and Libby. Libby, a PNAC founder and key visionary and promoter of America's 100-year Reich. Interesting word. Was an early champion of the modern biosecurity agenda. With multiple personal connections with the intelligence community at Yale, RAND, Northrop Grumman, and the Pentagon, the State Department's Bureau of East Asian and Pacific Affairs. His employer in the early 80s had and still has deep CIA ties. His obsession with bioterrorism led Libby to write a novel about smallpox pandemic and earn him the White House nickname Germ Boy. Following his pardon and subsequent prison release by President Donald Trump, Libby joined Robert Kadlec's Blue Ribbon Panel on Biodefense, which promotes biosecurity as a fulcrum of U.S. foreign policy. The 21st century, as the age of U.S. empire and mass vaccination as a foreign policy tool. Libby's fellow BRPB director, William Karish, is the executive vice president of Peter Danzig's EcoHealth Alliance, the organization through which Dr. Fauci, Kadlec, and the Pentagon, through DARPA, were launching a gain-of-function payments to Chinese scientists in Wuhan. Libby also serves as senior vice president of the Hudson Institute, a think tank in deep connections to the pharmaceutical industry, Monsanto, and the CIA. He guides the Institute's programs on national security and defense issues. In 2021, former CIA Director Mike Pompeo joined the Hudson Institute. That's just nice. The pervasive CIA involvement in the global vaccine push. That's a misprint. Unless that's a word, can somebody look up P-U-T-S-C-H? I think that's a misprint. Should give us pause. There is nothing in the CIA's history, in its charter, in its composition, or in its institutional culture that betrays an interest in promoting either public health or democracy. The CIA's historical preoccupations have been power and control. The CIA has been involved in at least 27 attempted and successful coup d'etats between 1947 and 1989. I think the actual number is like 70 or something like that, but who wants to nitpick, cherry pick? Involving about a third of the world's governments. Many of these were functioning democracies. The CIA does not do public health. It does not do democracy. The CIA does coup d'etats. No, that's not the word. P-U-T-S-C-H. I think that was the word. I can't find it now. Oh, yeah. P-U-T-S-C-H, yeah. Putsch. Secretly plotting and suddenly executed attempt to overthrow a government. Okay. Basically, a coup. Coup d'etat. Smallpox biosecurity blossoms. Dark winter was... I'm going to take a little 10-second break and get something to drink first. I think I finished that other page. Let me check. Yes. Smallpox biosecurity blossoms. Dark winter was part of a persistent campaign by the intelligence agencies and the bioweapons lobby to keep smallpox fears alive in the public consciousness. Even before the disease was eradicated in 1977, public health regulators had discontinued smallpox vaccinations in the U.S. Public health advocates urged the federal bureaucracies and the military to destroy their smallpox stockpile to prevent the disease from escaping and possibly disseminating humanity. Ignoring these warnings, the George W. Bush administration purchased even more. How wonderful. Oh, no, I got booted from chat. Ignoring these warnings, the George W. Bush administration purchased even more. During the run-up to the Iraqi war, President Bush aimed to inoculate the U.S. population with smallpox vaccines. Skeptics charged that the reckless scheme was PNAC's transparent gimmick for hyping fear of Saddam Hussein's mythological bioweapons program. Dr. Merle Nass, writing the history of the smallpox vaccine, later reported, "The smallpox vaccine was known to be highly reactogenic. When the vaccine was given to healthcare workers, the first responders in 2003, episodes of heart failure, heart attacks, myocarditis, and death quickly mounted. Doctors and nurses learned that they could not sue for damages if injured. And at first, there was no federal compensation either. They began refusing the vaccinations. How interesting. Very, very interesting. Right out of the playbook. The Clinton administration continued to stockpile millions of smallpox vaccines, and Congress allotted money for a compensation program, but the maximum award was only $250,000 for the permanent disability or death. After distributing 40 million inoculations, the wave of alarming industries caused the government to abandon the project's civilian arm. The military continued vaccination, vaccinating soldiers with the untested, unapproved, deadly vaccine with catastrophic results. The vaccine caused symptomatic myocarditis in 1 in every 216 soldiers and subclinical myocarditis in 1 in 35 soldiers. According to the 2015 U.S. Army study, government officials have since recognized vaccines as a probable culprit in the ERA's epidemic of Gulf War syndrome, which affected vaccinated soldiers, both deployed and those vaccinated in preparation for deployment, but never deployed. The court observed that absent an informed consent of presidential waiver, or presidential waiver, the United States cannot demand the members of the armed forces also serve as guinea pigs for experimental drugs. October 4, anthrax attack. Less than 4 months after the dark winter simulation, and 3 weeks after 9/11, mysterious spate of letters containing fine white anthrax spores arrived by mail at several news media outlets and Capitol Hill offices of two senators, Tom Daschle and Patrick Leahy. These two senators had been the most vocal on condemning the post 9/11 infringements on civil liberties pushed by the PNAC crowd. Somebody trying to send a message there? Oh, I know what it is. I know what that message is. I just figured that out. Saddam Hussein wanted to kill Tom Daschle and Patrick Leahy for not wanting to invade Iraq. That's what it was. It was all Saddam. Boy, he was a bad man. These two senators have been the most vocal in condemning the post 9/11 infringements on civil liberties pushed by the PNAC crowd. Administration and press accusations pegging Saddam Hussein as a probable culprit of the anthrax attacks, which killed 5 Americans, fueled Congress hasty passage of the Patriot Act. As Michael Moore proved, not a single elected member had read the bill, and its jingoistic declaration of war on Iraq. By abolishing traditional privacy protection, the Patriot Act created an entire terror industry. According to the 2021 report by Action Center on Race and Economy, the biggest beneficiaries have been Silicon Valley tech companies, particularly Amazon, Microsoft, and Google, who have partnered with federal intelligence agencies to mine data and profit from the war on terror by at least $44 billion since 2001. The Patriot Act passage, the report says, opened the door for big tech to become first and foremost the brokers of our personal data, selling it to secret agencies and private companies at home and abroad, unleashing the era of digital economy. Second only to Vice President Dick Cheney, the staunchest war hawk among George W. Bush's Beltway coterie was his Secretary of Defense, former Cyril Pharmaceutical CEO and PNAC chieftain Donald Rumsfeld, the very man who 14 years earlier had given Saddam his anthrax arsenal. While no one has ever proven the origin of the anthrax in those letters, the FBI concluded that the powder had come from the U.S. military lab. From a U.S. military lab. Robert Cadlick was among the first coterie, C-O-T-E-R-I-E. It's just a snob word. That's all I could say. Robert Cadlick was the first among the large coterie of pharmaceutical companies and military contractors to benefit from the anthrax scare. Immediately after the anthrax letters arrived, Cadlick became the special advisor on biological warfare to then Secretary of Defense Donald Rumsfeld and his PNAC deputy, Paul Wolfowitz. Three suspects, all linked to the U.S. military. The PNAC cabal was determined to blame the anthrax attacks on Saddam Hussein, and Rumsfeld deputy Paul Wolfowitz tasked Cadillac with confirming the presence of bentonite in the anthrax used in the attacks. Experts had advised Rumsfeld and Wolfowitz that bentonite was a fingerprint unique in Iraq. Anthrax stocks its presence uniquely in Iraq. Anthrax stocks its presence would therefore put the blame on Saddam. Cadillac did not succeed in finding bentonite in any of the anthrax samples and the FBI that the FBI tested, but repeated media reports claimed otherwise allowed warmongers to drum up jingoistic hysteria against Saddam. By late October 2001, one nationwide poll found that 74% of respondents wanted the United States to take military action against Baghdad, despite a complete lack of evidence connecting Iraq to either 9/11 or the anthrax attacks. Alrighty, time for another break here. Mark my spot. If I don't, I lose it. I got a little X in about 40 pages, 50 pages or whatever. So if I go back and read it, or if somebody else reads it, they'll know what that means. Let's see here. I guess about a 6-minute song. Be back in 6 minutes.
Sinking sand.
Okay, welcome back after the break, everyone. Thanks for staying. Got a bookmarker in here, and I can't even turn to the right page. The pages are so stiff. Instead of pointing the finger at Saddam, the FBI lab found that the smallpox spores originated from one of the three U.S. Army labs, Fort Detrick, a lab at the University of Scranton, and the Orr Battelle's West Jefferson facility, owned by Al Habri, business partner. The FBI closed this investigation after its leading suspect, a vaccinologist, Dr. Bruce Ivins, who ran the U.S. lab, U.S. Army lab at Fort Detrick, allegedly took his own life. Killed him and then blamed it on him, I'll bet. A multitude of critics of this shoddy and haphazard FBI investigation complained that Ivins was the victim of ham-handed FBI frame. According to the FBI's former lead investigator, Richard Lambert, the FBI team hid a mountain of evidence that would have exonerated Ivins. In 2008, following Ivins' untimely suicide, the Department of Justice civil attorney in Florida defending a claim by the widow of anthrax victim Robert Stevens publicly challenged the FBI's assertions that Ivins had been the culprit and instead pointedly suggested that the privately owned laboratory in Ohio, managed by Battelle and linked to Al Habri's could have been involved in the attacks. Department of Justice headquarters quickly had its Florida attorneys rewrite that brief, omitting this claim. Interesting. An Italian publication, Il Manifesto, reported in its October 2001 issue that the FBI had placed the El Habris on its subject list for sending the anthrax spores through the U.S. mail. Qui bono. Somebody doesn't know what that means. That's Latin for who benefits. I don't even know if he's going to say that, but I knew what that meant. Since 1995, Cadillac had been frothing about bioterrorism to war college students and urging the creation of a Strategic National Stockpile, SNS, to warehouse vaccines and other countermeasures. In 2004, with Cadillac now working for Secretary Rumsfeld at the Bush White House, Congress passed the Public Health Security and Bioterrorism Preparedness Act, with Cadillac drafted, directing the national security of HHS to maintain a strategic national stockpile, managed jointly by DHS and HHS. The same week, Congress passed the Project BioShield Act, which Cadillac also helped draft, launching the Biomedical Advanced Research and Development Authority, BARDA, a government-operated investment bank that would germinate new technologies for Cadillac's stockpile. With Cadillac's guidance, BARDA would become a federal ATM machine for big pharma, biodefense and contractors, and gain-of-function researchers. Along with Dr. Fauci's NIAID, the Pentagon's DARPA, superbugs in Wuhan and elsewhere, Cadillac's stature authorized the purchase of $5 billion of materiel, including vaccines for the stockpile, creating a gold mine, as we shall see, for Cadillac's friends, the El Habris. Another conspicuous beneficiary of the stockpile was then Secretary of State Donald Rumsfeld and Cadillac's boss, who made a killing during the 2004 fake bird flu pandemic, which Tony Fauci ginned up with his confederate and ambitious young British physician and Wellcome Trust researcher Jeremy Farrar. 16 years later, as director of Wellcome Trust, Farrar would play a key role in the 2020 Wuhan cover-up. The Pentagon, in 2004 and 2005, in response to Farrar's concocted contagion, stockpiled 80 million doses of Gilead's flu remedy, Tamiflu. Secretary Rumsfeld had served on the board of Gilead from 1988 till 2001, and was as chairman from 1997 until he joined the Bush administration as defense secretary. He retained stock in the pharmaceutical company, which netted him $5 million profit from the Tamiflu run-up. George Shultz, another PNAC war hawk, also hit the jackpot, cashing in $7 million of Gilead stock during the Tamiflu run-up. The biggest winners, however, were the El Habris. The anthrax attacks brought them exoneration, salvation, and extravagant windfalls. Bioport's rebirth and reinvention of emergent biosolutions. Anthrax arrived just in time for the El Habris. Bioport was then on the ropes. The Al-Habri's anthrax vaccine facility was facing bankruptcy and the loss of its operating license. Bioport's contagion contract expired in August 2001, with the host of outstanding accounting mysteries impending its renewal. The Pentagon had given Bioport millions to renovate its factory, but much of that money instead financed senior management bump bonuses and an opulent makeover for Al-Habri's executive offices. Millions more simply disappeared, according to the journalist Whitney Webb. In 2002, not long after receiving its first Pentagon bailout, Bioport contracted none other than Battelle Memorial Institute to cultivate its anthrax seed stock. Cadillac's boss, Donald Rumsfeld, told aides that his biosecurity priority after the incidents of anthrax sent through the mail was rescuing Bioport. "We're going to try to save it and try to fashion some sort of arrangement whereby we give one more crack at getting the job done with that outfit. It's the only outfit in this country that has anything underway. It's not very well underway, as you point out." Gold Rush. In the summer of 2001, 2 months before the 9/11 World Trade Center attacks, the Department of Defense officially launched its drive to receive bioweapons research by sending a report to Congress, authored by Cadillac, pleading that the military systems for developing vaccines to protect troops from anthrax, smallpox, and other exotic bioweapons is insufficient and will fail. Beginning with the 9/11 attack, the war on terror triggered a tectonic shift in global security priorities and elephantine ripples in defense spending patterns across the globe as open democracies began shifting to security state footing. The revival of U.S. government interest in germ warfare opened new opportunities. The U.S. biodefense budget spent from $137 million in 1997 to $14.5 billion for 2001-2004. Every agency with a colorable claim to the national security function paddled out frantically to barrel the money tsunami. Between 2001 and 2014, the U.S. spent around $80 billion on biodefense. Since germ weaponry is still illegal, vaccines become a critical euphemism for the survival of the multi-billion-dollar bioweapons industry. Pentagon sources told Science magazine that the military was applying for a sweeping overhaul of how the federal government develops vaccines to protect both the military and civilians. The Pentagon's assault on the vaccine space was both an opportunity and a threat to Dr. Fauci and the NIAID. U.S. Vice President Cheney and his PNEC Confederates found some convenient loopholes in the Geneva Convention, through which they drove a 40-fold expansion of spending in biological weapons research. The Department of Defense had strict systems in place to ensure compliance with the Biological Weapons Convention. These restrictions limited the Pentagon's freedom to undertake new research programs, particularly those referred to as the leading edge of biodefense. Cheney's response, calls Professor Richard Ebright, was to transfer this research from the Department of Defense to the National Institutes of Health, specifically to the National Institute of Allergy and Infectious Diseases, NIAID. By about 2004, this transfer was complete, and the NIAID had been transformed into the arm of the defense sector. This made the NIAID director, Anthony Fauci, a major player in the biodefense and germ warfare. Dr. Fauci sharpened his elbows and began maneuvering the leading role for the NIAID and milking the BARDA Homeland Security's cash cows. NIAID's biosecurity budget went from $0 in 2000 to $1 billion after the 2001 anthrax letters. Much of that for bioweapons vaccines. Yeah, I wonder who benefited. Within 5 months following the anthrax postal incidents, Dr. Fauci had created two new sub-agencies to capture his share of the cheese. The NIAID Strategic Plan for Biodefense Research and the NIAID Biodefense Research Agency for CDC Category A agents, which were those microorganisms designated by CDC to be potentially pandemic pathogens. To populate the sub-agencies, he assembled a cadre of his loyal deputies and infectious disease principal investigators from the HIV bonanza. Their mission was to brand contagions as pressing terror threats, drum up pandemic panic, and lobby for government support for NIAID's new battery of biodefense vaccinations. Dr. Fauci and the El Hebres found common cause. Dr. Fauci could run interference for the El Hebres at FDA, overriding regulatory anxieties about bioports, laboratory, and product safety. The El Hebres, in turn, provided Dr. Fauci with ready-made biodefense vaccines and a beachhead into the arcane maze of military contracting. Taking to the airwaves, Dr. Fauci made himself the face of biodefense. In a style now familiar to Americans, Fauci warned the public that postal workers who had handled the letters containing the anthrax spores might still be harboring these in their lungs, even after taking 2 months of antibiotics, spreading plague with the morning mail. Taking the El Hebres vaccine prophylactically, Dr. Fauci advised, might help. Dr. Fauci's signature fear-mongering was, of course, his trademark science-free speculation. Nestling the El Hebres under his protective wing, Dr. Fauci swept aside FDA's safety concerns and publicly praised BioPort's experimental anthrax vaccine. Biothrax. He brushed aside the reservations of critics that the El Hebres never established Biothrax's safety with some of his prototypical dissembling. Dr. Fauci said the vaccine is designed to get the immune system to recognize the proteins, and therefore the bacteria, and destroy both. In the December 2001 PBS interview, Fauci promised to deliver Biothrax, which had failed to pass a single FDA audit team during the prior 4 years. At record pace, Fauci exclaimed, "In unusual times, there is a process that takes years and years." But he committed that the project for delivering Biothrax is going to be remarkably truncated because of the urgency of the situation. PBS observed that because of Bioport's production problems, the Pentagon had dramatically scaled back its plan to vaccinate U.S. forces. And there were insufficient anthrax vaccines in the Pentagon stockpile to conduct a mass civilian inoculation program that had been Dr. Fauci's ultimate aim. But Bioport still possessed the only military contract, and Fouad El-Habri announced he was primed to ramp up production. Practically every veteran federal bureaucrat was jockeying to ride the war on terror into the high-stakes winner's circle. The military's medical coup, I'm sorry, medical corps, maneuvering for a share of overflowing stream of bioterrorism funding, had proposed that each American soldier should receive 25 new vaccines upon enlistment to cover every potential bioweapon. The brass asked President Bush to finance the development of this inoculation facilade. F-U-S-I-L-L-A-D-E. Fusillade. I don't know. Not to be outgunned by the military doctors, Dr. Fauci announced in an October 2002 speech that within 10 years, his institute would produce a vaccine, a therapeutic drug, and an adjuvant drug for each of some 24 bioweapons diseases, such as plague and hemorrhagic fever. According to an article in Scientific American, one scientist who requested anonymity said that Dr. Fauci told him that the Bush administration had demanded this goal and that he accepted it to prevent the Department of Defense or the Department of Homeland Security from getting the job. Dr. Fauci was openly competing with the military in an escalating campaign to soak up taxpayers, using the risk posed by anthrax as a pretext. NIAID's biodefense budget alone increased sixfold from 2002 to 2003, from $270 million to $1.75 billion. That's a big increase. Big raise. Trying to figure out what that is. About a seven times increase. Something like that. Dr. Fauci skillfully maintained his annual $1.7 billion biosecurity funding to deftly recalibrating his rhetoric away from bioterrorism hype. Instead, he invoked a new panic of natural but emerging infectious diseases. Dr. Fauci's pivot to conflate infectious diseases with terrorism proved a milestone inflection point into the militarization of pandemic response and in overcoming the traditional revulsion among Western democracies, codified the Nuremberg chapter against coercive medical interventions. Despite the fact that they collectively killed only 800 people globally, the SARS coronavirus outbreaks between 2002 and 2004 were therefore a godsend to Dr. Fauci. The fact that the coronavirus lab escapes in China, Taiwan, and Singapore had precipitated several of the outbreaks. Fauci boasted in 2011, through the anthrax response, we built both a physical and an intellectual infrastructure that can be used to respond to a broad range of emerging health threats. By that time, the escalating intramural arms race to capture Pentagon, CIA, BARDA, DARPA, and HHS biosecurity funding was pulling the military, CIA, NIAID, deeper and deeper into the dicey alchemy of gain-of-function research that would ultimately culminate inside the BSL-4 Pandora's box in Wuhan. Okay, I think I'm going to take a little break here early. A minute early or so. Not really that much early, but I probably could have read another paragraph. But, well, let's see here. I guess a couple songs I haven't played in a while. I guess almost 8 minutes break here, so go get you a cup or a sandwich or something. Cup of tea or coffee or a sandwich. Be back in almost 8 minutes. I'm sorry, almost 9 minutes.
The love of God has been extended to a fallen race through Christ the Savior of all men. There's hope in saving grace. The love of God is greater more than gold or silver.
Okay, in case somebody didn't hear, that was a new song that I recorded last week by Bill Haley before he went to the Comets, or before it became Bill Haley and the Comets. The CIA dips in its toes. The CIA has a long, sordid history of secretly promoting the bioweapons program. One of the agency's first projects was establishing a network of so-called rat lines that Army intelligence officers used to smuggle some 1,600 chemicals and bioweapons and WMD experts, many of them Nazi party kingpins and notorious war criminals, out of the reach of the Allies, Nuremberg prosecutors following World War II, also called Operation Paperclip. I put that in there. He didn't. I'm sure he's going to cite that somewhere in here. Most assuredly, he should be. He should cite that. The directors of the notorious operation, codename Paperclip, yep, there it is, provided these researchers with new identities and put them to work developing U.S. germ warfare capacity at Fort Detrick and elsewhere even after 1972. As late as 1997, the CIA defied the bioweapons treaty to launch a top-secret and highly illegal effort to create a doomsday bacteria bomblet. The CIA officially made its open debut in the biosecurity racket in 2004 with its launch of Argus, a project that monitors biological terrorists and pandemic threats in 178 nations. CIA operative and pediatrician Jill Wilson set up the program at Georgetown University with funding from DHS and the Intelligence Innovation Center to create the and implement global foreign biological event detection and tracking capability, capable of assessing millions of pieces of information about social behavior daily, and to train government officials in pandemic preparedness. One of the key figures in this global surveillance effort was CIA officer Dr. Michael Callahan. It's a cool little song. I wonder if he did some more gospel songs besides that one. Maybe you can look that up, Annie. Dr. Michael Callahan is one of the biggest names in bioweapons research. Dr. Callahan ran the biosecurity program for the former CIA surrogate, USAID, before serving as director of DARPA's bioweapons research program. At DARPA, he competed to outdo in the NIH in laundering money through Peter Daszak's EcoHealth Alliance to perform bioweapons research, including at the Wuhan lab. And as DARPA director, Callahan launched the PREDICT project in 2009 following Jeremy Farrar's fake bird flu pandemic. PREDICT appeared to be a reincarnation of the CIA's Argus project under the cover of USAID. PREDICT is the largest single source of funding to Daszak, with a $3.4 million subgrant routed through the University of California, 2015 through 2020. PREDICT became the largest funder of gain-of-function studies and served as a principal funding vehicle through which the gain-of-function cartel evaded Barack Obama's 2014 presidential moratorium. When during the height of the presidential gain-of-function moratorium, Ralph Baric and the UTMB labs Vineet Menachery brazenly published their alarming 2015 study, describing their reckless experiments to breed pandemic bat coronaviruses that could spread via respiratory droplets in humanized mice. They omitted mentioning in their initial online version of the article that one of the funding sources was USAID EPT Predict. Apparently hoping to cover its tracks, Predict had laundered its grant through Peter Daszak's EcoHealth Alliance. USAID's Predict program boasts that it has identified almost 1,000 new viruses, including a new strain of Ebola, and trained some 5,000 people in October 2019, not long before COVID-19 emerged. USAID abruptly ceased funding Predict, a decision bemoaned by Daszak in the New York Times as definitely a loss. Callahan had chummy relations with Daszak, with whom he co-authored several articles, including Throughout the Gain-of-Function Moratorium. In April 2015, for example, the names of Michael V. Callahan and Peter Daszak appeared as co-authors on a paper published in the Virology Journal, had titled Diversity of Coronavirus in Bats from Eastern Thailand. Callahan was well aware that he and his confederates were toying with fire. In 2005, Callahan testified before Congress. As he was moving into his new office at DARPA, he concluded the hearing was a chilling warning about the nation's new commitment to jaundice-faced gain-of-function science that Drs. Fauci, Robert Cadillac, and Callahan himself, and many others would proceed to blithely ignore. The dark science of biology, weapon design, and manufacture parallels that of the health sciences, and the cross-mix disciples in modern technology, potential advances in biomedical weapon lethality will, in part, be the byproduct of peaceful scientific progress. So upon the time when there are no more terrorists, the U.S. government and the American people will depend on the scientific leaders of their field to identify any potential dark side aspect of every achievement. That was his quote in the to Congress. Even after leaving DARPA and USAID, Callahan periodically boasted on his continuing influence over U.S. pandemic response policies at the highest levels of government. He alluded to his confidence in these mysterious connections in 2012. I still have federal responsibilities to the White House for pandemic preparedness and exotic disease outbreak, which will continue for the near future. On January 4th, 2020, Callahan called Dr. Robert Malone from China, just as the coronavirus began taking its first wave of casualties. Malone, a former contractor to the U.S. Army Medical Research Institute of Infectious Diseases and the chief medical officer of Alcom Laboratories, is the inventor of the mRNA vaccine technology platform. Malone first met Callahan in 2009 through Malone's sometime business partner, Daryl Calloway, a CIA officer who formerly served as the U.S. Navy and at one point held the post of director of JSTO in the
Defense Threat Reduction Agency. To Malone, Galloway introduced Callahan as a fellow CIA officer. During his January 4th phone call, Callahan told Malone that he was just outside Wuhan. Malone assumed that Callahan was visiting China under cover of his Harvard and Massachusetts General Hospital appointments. Callahan subsequently described to National Geographic how he had pored through thousands of case studies at the outbreak's epicenter. He giddily reported his amazement at the virus's magnificent infectivity and its capacity to explode like a silent smart bomb in your community. Callahan later confessed to Malone that he lacked authority to be in Wuhan and had escaped by boat when the government imposed its quarantine. Callahan repeated parts of this story to Brandon Borrell, a writer of science, later DTRA scientist, David Hone, a GS-15 officer, warned Malone to stop talking about Callahan, saying that we had no military personnel in Wuhan at the time of the outbreak, and Michael was lying about his presence. Malone told me that would mean that Michael also lied to Brendan Burrell. On leaving China, Callahan returned to Washington to brief federal officers, federal officials, and then went directly to work as a special advisor to Robert Kedlick, managing the government's response to the coronavirus. Robert Kedlick as Bad Santa, the Alhibra's cash-in. By 2011, Bioport was already profiting handsomely in the bioweapons vaccine space. After 9/11, President Bush, presumably at the urging of Secretary Rumsfeld, Robert Kedlick and Dr. Fauci, whose advice he valued, had placed Bioport's Michigan lab under protection in the national interest. Alhibra and his son, gnawing on gristle after the October 4, began fattening themselves with NIAID and BARDA contracts. With friends like Fauci and Kedlick in high places, Bioport, which changed its name to Emergent Biosolutions in 2004 to escape its checkered past, was enjoying the first bright days of the charmed journey that would place Alhibra's among the elite army of COVID-19 nouveau billionaires in 2021. After 2001, Rumsfeld's Pentagon agreed to hike Bioport's compensation by 30%, from 3.35 in its 1998 contract to 4.70 per dose, and to produce anthrax shots for 2.4 million members of the armed forces, each of whom the military would require to receive 6 doses over an 18-month period. That was $60 million worth of poorly performed and unapproved vaccines for the threat that never again surfaced. The anthrax threat was always plantasmagoric. Since anthrax does not spread through human-to-human transmission. Terrorists plotting an anthrax pandemic would need to somehow simultaneously release spores over dozens of U.S. cities. The anthrax deal was exceptionally ridiculous, since antibiotics are far safer, more elegant, and more useful defense against anthrax. The prescribed remedy, ciprofloxacin, is a cheap, commonly used antibiotic that Tony Fauci himself recommended after the 2001 postal incidents. The best approach toward anthrax is antimicrobial therapy, Dr. Fauci admitted to Congress in 2007. Indeed, the night of the 9/11 attacks in the White House medical office, thoughtfully and presciently dispensed ciprofloxacin to select White House staff who were accompanying Dick Cheney to the safety of Camp David. Furthermore, the El Hebre's anthrax jab was by far the worst of a bad lot. According to the Times, Emergent's anthrax vaccine was not the government's first choice. It was more than 30 years old and plagued by manufacturing challenges and complaints about side effects. Officials instead backed a company named Vaxgen, which was developing a vaccine using newer technology licensed from the military. In 2004, the El Hebre's, co-founded with their partner and former Joint Chiefs Admiral William Crowe, a lobbying group called the Alliance of Biosecurity, as part of their strategy to secure lucrative BARDA-funded BioShield contracts and beat back upstart competitors like Vaxgen. That lobbying group recruited two of the Johns Hopkins Center for Biosecurity spooks with whom Cadillac had written the Dark Winter simulation. Tara O'Toole and Colonel Randall Larson, and enlisted more than 50 lobbyists to successfully block Vaxgen from muscling in on its locked-up anthrax government monopoly. With these sorts of friends in high places, Emergent made a national strategic stockpile with an exclusive captive market. By 2006, Vaxgen had lost its $800 million contract and was bankrupt, and Emergent remaining the government's sole source of monopoly. Emergent then purchased Vaxgen's anthrax vaccine for $2 million at pennies on the dollar. Quite nice of them. In 2021, a New York Times expose titled, How One Firm Put an Extraordinary Burden on the U.S. Troubled Stockpile, documented Emergent's airtight domination on stockpile purchases. As Emergent prospered, other companies worked on pandemic remedies for the stockpile were squeezed out by government spending decisions. Several federal health officials anonymously told the Times that preparations for an outbreak like COVID-19 almost always took a back seat to Emergent's anthrax vaccines. In 2011, the El Hebre's connections had put Emergent in the driver's seat. Despite its vaccine's glaring and dangerous deficiencies, Emergent received $107 million in 2010 from Cadillac's baby, BARDA, and up to $29 million from Fauci's NIAID to develop Nuthrax, its old anthrax vaccine, with a new adjuvant. For large-scale manufacture in 2014. By 2010, Emergent's anthrax vaccine price had risen to about $28 now closer to 30 per dose. With 75% profit margin for the El Hebrides. As with BioThrax, the El Hebrides never performed functional safety testing for Nuthrax, and the FDA has never approved the vaccine. But BARDA recently contracted for $261 million with this experimental and notoriously dangerous unlicensed anthrax vaccine. By then, the company had grown from a single corporate office in Rockville, Maryland, to headquarters in Seattle, Munich, and Singapore. Its projects included developing vaccines for pandemic flu and tuberculosis and partnering in partnership with Oxford University and with funding from the Gates Foundation. Despite Nuthrax's failure to win FDA approval, almost half of the strategic national stockpile, $500 million annual budget prior to 2010, went to emergence two anthrax vaccines, a cost that, according to the New York Times, left the government with less money to buy supplies needed in a pandemic. Alrighty, that's going to be the end right here, everyone. Mark my spot. And thank everyone for coming out and staying out. Yeah, I'm just going to play a short song myself here, Annie. I can find one, short one. Sure I can. I have plenty of them. I just got to find one. Yeah, this one will be good enough right here. So thanks for coming out, everyone. If you come out tomorrow for me and Roger, I'll see you then.